I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a plea to take hip-hop back to its origins. But first, let's check in Washington. In the fourth and final day of debate on an Iraq war resolution, Democrat after Democrat rose today to praise the measure's move to support the troops but oppose the president's troop surge in Iraq. Texas Democrat Al Green.
In addition to blood, sweat, and tears, the American people have spent more than $267 million, not per year, not per month, not per week, but more than $267 million per day on this war.
And Republican after Republican expressed support for the president, their concerns about possible failure in Iraq, and concerns about their own political future, Oregon Republican Greg Walden.
I know that I stand alone in my state's delegation by opposing this resolution. I've been told by some I should just vote for it. It'd be easier politically for me because then the problem's off my back. It's someone else's. They'll own it. I cannot do that and look at myself in the mirror.
Well, joining us on the line from Capitol Hill, Boston Globe congressional correspondent Rick Klein. Rick, some projections have had as many as 40 Republicans defecting to support this resolution. But earlier today in his speech, Barney Frank, congressman from Massachusetts, said there were many unspoken Republicans who haven't declared which way they'll vote yet. So what's the thinking at the end of the day? What will it be?
Yeah, it's really an open question. It's a fascinating little mystery that we'll know the answer to in a few hours. But I think the low number of around 30, high number maybe around 50 or 60, depending on how comfortable Republicans feel with abandoning the president, which is that really even 30 or 40 would be a pretty extraordinary number given the strong support the president has enjoyed for most of the time of the Iraq war among Republicans.
Well, Maryland Republican Roscoe Bartlett indicated he might vote present on the measure instead of yay or nay. Have you heard that as well?
That was really the first that I'd heard of that, although that could be a significant number of Republicans who are uncomfortable with the war but also uncomfortable siding with the Democrats and their particular message that they're sending here. That we could see some folks who essentially are voting voting undecided by voting present on this is a more quiet protest against the way that the Iraq war has progressed.
Well, if there is as big a defection, though, as 40 to 60 lawmakers, what will the Republican leadership say about that?
I think what they'll say is that it was a lot of political posturing by the Democrats that forced their colleagues into it. Obviously, they have to acknowledge at this point that their caucus is split on it, but what Republicans have been focusing on over the last few days is the fact that they're not able to offer their own competing resolution that could draw a large number of Republicans, maybe some Democrats as well. One resolution, a pretty simple resolution that Republicans have wanted to offer, is just a simple statement on whether Congress intends to cut off funds for the troops or not. And I think it's pretty clear if that were to come for a vote, it would get a larger vote than anything that the Democrats are able to offer.
Well, the Democrats are saying that this resolution today is just the first step. What more are we hearing about what they plan for the future? And that is a move that's being pushed by Pennsylvania veteran John Murtha, of course, one of the first to speak out about the war in Iraq. A proposal that the monies be redirected, the war money be redirected. What more are we hearing about that?
Yeah, Congressman Murtha is in an interesting spot here. He's the head of the appropriations panel that handles defense issues. So he's got really more power than almost anyone in the House to his vision forward. What he wants to do is attach a number of conditions that would have the impact of forcing the president to reverse course on the troop surge, adding conditions like requiring a year off between tours of duty for service members, requiring more training back on the home front, sort of starve the president of the number of troops that he'd need to keep them in the field of the numbers he wants.
And by the way, this would be binding.
That's right. This would actually, if the president were to veto this, it would have the impact of denying him funding for the war. So it has quite a bit more in terms of teeth than anything that's happening so far in the House.
Okay, quick look ahead, Rick, because now, as of yesterday, we know the Senate is also going to be called back from their president's weekend vacation to debate tomorrow on their war resolution. First of all, were they forced by the House?
I think, in large part, yes. They were sort of embarrassed. Senate leaders were embarrassed that the House had to go first on this because of procedural obstacles that the Republicans put up. But I think what Majority Leader Harry Reid is hoping for is some momentum out of the House vote that's going to shift votes and allow the debate to move forward finally in the Senate.
Will it be the same resolution that they were speaking of earlier?
Yes, that's the latest thinking. It's a very streamlined, very simple. This House resolution is only three sentences long. It just says we support the troops and that we don't approve of the president's troop surge.
And the this is the Warner resolution that the Senate will be debating?
No, it's a different resolution.
That's what, yeah.
It's modeled more on the House resolution.
I see, yeah. And just quickly, and very briefly, what support does Democratic presidential candidate Senator Joe Biden have for the measure he's proposing, which is to repeal the 2002 authorization for war?
That's an interesting question. It's sort of a side issue in all of this. I think if that were to happen, there'll be a lot of questions about what the president could and couldn't do legally. So it's something that Biden just introduced yesterday. It's gotten a lot of people talking. It's something that other people have talked about for some time, that because the mission has changed so much, that the original authorization should be repealed and or changed.
Well, it's something we'll hear more about then in the coming days. Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That is Grammy winner Ludacris singing Girls Gone Wild. Did you hear his shout out at the Grammys to conservative talk show host Bill O'Reilly? He said thank you. Ludacris, of course, was being sarcastic. O'Reilly has been a critic. But hip-hop has now come under the searching lens of an African-American filmmaker, Byron Hurt, who says,
"One thing I really want to say, And I want to make this very clear to all my viewers out there, I love hip-hop."
That's how he begins his new film, Hip Hop, Beyond Beats and Rhymes. He looks at the violence, the sexism, the homophobia, and the hype of hip-hop, as well as the voice it gives young black men in particular. The film is being screened this month as part of the Independent Lens series, and we want to talk more about it today. So joining us from the Argo Networks is Byron Hurt. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
First of all, what launched your quest?
Well, I would have to go back to 1993 when I was working at the Center for the Study of Sport in Society.
At Northeastern University.
Right at Northeastern University, where I graduated. That program, the Mentors and Violence Prevention Program, gave me the framework to look at everything in my life from a totally different perspective, to look at it from a pro-feminist male perspective. Because at that time, I was very much a hip-hop head. I would listen to hip-hop pretty much 95 to 99% of the time I was listening to music. But when I started going through this program and I started to better understand the pervasiveness of gender violence, I started to really listen to hip-hop a lot more critically. In my film, Hip-Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes, I focus on violence and sexism and homophobia in the music and the art form. But really, what I'm really focusing on is how all of these things have become normal in hip-hop. That is what I want to question throughout the film, but also taking a look at the larger American structure that perpetuates and reinforces all of these narrow visions of manhood that all men are subjected to.
Oh, sure. A lot of white cowboys make their way into the film at the top. You've got these old movies with the shoot 'em out at the OK Corral.
Absolutely. I mean, I thought that was a really appropriate place to start having that conversation, and an honest way to have that conversation, because, you know, the violence that we see in hip-hop, we see all of the time in American culture.
I mean, if you watch Hollywood movies, you see the same kind of violence, the same kind of hyper-masculine violence perpetuated in movie after movie after movie.
You question the violence in hip-hop music, but, you know, what do you say to people who say, yeah, but there is violence in a lot of African-American communities? There's a death rate that can't be ignored, and we need an outlet to talk about that.
Well, I think that they are right when they say that. And I think that the level of violence in communities of color is way too high. And I think that even going back to what I was saying earlier about how that has been normalized is very, very troubling and very sad to me. But I think that there's a really fine line between, you know, sort of speaking truth to power about the circumstances in your community, in your neighborhood, and the exploitation of those circumstances for corporate profit. And I think that's what's happening.
Well, and then you set off on this sojourn to talk to fans, to people in the industry, to scholars, to hip-hop artists, to some of the superstars. And you start talking in the film about the need to be hard men, it's called. You spoke to rappers, for instance, here's Fat Joe, talking about, you know, even they don't get it, this idea of you need to be a hard man.
When they walking around the club, I'm wondering why we can't just walk around and smile at each other. Why are we all there to do the same thing, have a nice time, party and get drunk and enjoy the music, but we all looking at everybody like, and this be writers, journalists like you, you know, it be good people working who be up in the club like.
Byron Hurt, what does hard men mean in hip hop?
Well, the whole idea of being hard is something that has existed in hip hop for a long time. And I would probably even say in the lives of black men for a long time. It's just this whole idea that, you know, we have to project this image and this aura of invincibility and toughness when we're around each other, you know, and that's really what it's about.
You go to the BET Spring Bling, which is the big festival down in Florida, and and you record some guys just rapping to each other, and it almost feels like, as you say in the film, they're trapped in this language, trapped in a box, as you say. Let's listen.
Finish it. Yeah. Mac with extended clips. Clap at the innocent. Clap at the bystanders. Clap at the witnesses. You can always find me flipping bricks in the kitchen. And my connect so real, I get it in prison.
The most saleable, the most consumable, you know, form of hip hop that we see all of the time is the type of hyper aggression that you see that is directed toward other rappers, you know. And so that's something that I wanted to sort of, you know, challenge and question in the film.
Well, your travels then take you to Spelman College. Now, we remember Spelman College is the African-American Women's College in Atlanta. And the hip-hop artist Nelly was scheduled to make a visit there. It became very controversial. Now, he does great work by sponsoring bone marrow drives, but he also puts out an energy drink called Pimp Juice. And he has a music video for a song called Tip Drill, where he swipes a credit card down a woman's bottom. We need a tip drill. I said, now come on, girl, you know what we came here for. We need a tip drill. I got a tip drill. It provoked a huge protest at Spelman. But you speak in the film with other African-American girls and ask them if they're offended by the lyrics to hip-hop music. And here's one other girl's reaction.
Well, if it's not really directed towards you personally. It's just what they say. Sex sells. If you don't take offense to it, then hey.
I think it's a form of protection, you know, self-preservation and protection. And a defense mechanism, and in a way to sort of disassociate yourself to say, I'm not a part of that group that these guys are talking about. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's on another level, I think it's a form of internalized sexism as well. I mean, you know, you internalize these ideas that women are less than, less valuable. And I think you sort of buy into it, which makes it easier for you to be complicit to the sexism and the misogyny that does exist in some hip-hop.
Well, you also focus on homosexuality. And Busta Rhymes, one of the hip-hop artists that you speak to, won't even talk to you about it. He walks out of the room. What? Why is it so threatening?
You know what? I don't know. I don't know why. I mean, I think part of it is just the way that we've been trained and socialized as guys to see homosexuality. But, you know, it just goes to show you the level of homophobia that exists, not just in rap music, but just in American culture. Although I think that popular culture in many ways is a little bit of ahead of the curve than hip hop is, because, I mean, there's really no place for a homosexual rapper to really be really successful in the genre at this particular point in hip hop history.
That's filmmaker Byron Hurt. We're talking to him about his critical look at hip hop music. It's called Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes documentary. When we come back, we'll ask him, you know, how he was received by the hip hop establishment. More with Byron after the break. But just as a reminder, Fox Television has announced that it's going to be changing its tune on torture in its hit show 24. Did it have to do with a visit from a general this past fall? That's all coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Hera now. We're back with Byron Hurt. His new documentary is called Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes. And Byron, we were saying that rappers walk down on you when you ask them about black-on-black violence and homophobia. But a programmer for the Black Entertainment Network, BET, walked out too.
The BET executive that I talked to is named Stephen Hill. And I asked him some questions about how he feels as someone who programs hip-hop music videos, how he feels about the representations of manhood, black manhood in rap music and hip-hop culture on BET, and he didn't want to talk about that. So it was really interesting to see how that played out.
A lot of people just, you know, sort of didn't want to talk to you. You seem to be on the other side of this issue a lot of places you went, and I wonder if that's tough for you, you know, in questioning the music of young black men, phenomenally successful music financially. You know, did anyone accuse you of, you know, being like the man, the white establishment, the good black, if you will, you know, questioning the one thing that's successful but maybe just a little too threatening to whites?
Truthfully, I did have some concerns about how the hip-hop community would receive me and my perspective in this film. But I think there's a really, really, really big difference between someone like myself who grew up with hip-hop, who listens to hip-hop, who knows the culture, and someone who's totally disconnected from the culture, who doesn't know the music, who doesn't have a respect for the artistry of it, the Bill O'Reillys of the world. I mean, I'm not Bill O'Reilly. I'm somebody from the inside who knew and understood the great potential for hip-hop and saw how hip-hop had become derailed, if you will, as it became larger and bigger.
And interestingly, everyone you talked to got it, knew what you were mm-hmm. talking about. At one point, you're talking to a group of wannabe rappers, and one of them does a more thoughtful kind of rap. Let's listen to the reaction to it.
I could walk up to you right now and say, yo, could have been a doctor, or I could have been a pops. Wonder what would have happened had I would have been a cop. Would I help the block, protect the good from the bad, or just be killing niggas because the power on my badge? You know what I mean? That's nice, but nobody want to hear that right now. They don't accept that.
Who's the industry? They don't give us deals when we speak righteously and things of that nature.
Byron Hurt, there was another rap song that a lot of rappers in your film spoke of nostalgically. It's KRS-One's Self Destruction, popular in the 80s, slams negativity in rap and slams black-on-black crime, talks about empowerment. What are rappers saying about that now?
Well, a lot of the feeling is that, you know, a song like Self Destruction would not be supported in today's hip-hop culture, in today's hip-hop climate, you know, or hip-hop market, that, you know, will be either seen as too threatening or, you know, too radical or too racialized or what. I don't know how people review it, but just the idea that conscious hip-hop does not sell and that nobody wants to hear, quote-unquote, conscious hip-hop or hip-hop that is pro-black, you know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. which is what hip-hop was in the mid to late 80s.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, hip-hop has since been embraced by white fans. You talk to many of them. One is in his dad's SUV, trying to convince you that even though he's in an SUV, he's cool, you know.
Yeah.
And another time you speak to a group of white teenagers, and they speak about hip-hop, well, perhaps maybe as some are thinking, I'm speaking about it right now, as if it's a, you know, performed by people on another planet. Let's listen.
I've never been to a ghetto. I grew up in, you know, upper middle class, basically white suburbia. We had a very small minority in our town, and that was it. And to listen to stuff like that is a way of us to see almost a different culture, well, a completely different culture. It's something that most of us have never had the opportunity to experience. I've never had to worry about drive-by shootings and the stuff in the music. It appeals to our sense of learning about other cultures and wanting to know more about something that we'll never probably experience.
Byron, how maybe that's what you were talking about. How does that feel to have, a white person thinking that she's learning about you through mm-hmm. this music?
Well, I mean, it's frustrating. It's sad and it's frustrating. Sometimes it upsets me. I mean, I was just on the internet yesterday and I was looking at these images of these gangster parties that took place down at Clemson University, and there was another one that I think took place at the University of Connecticut, where these white college students were dressing up like thugs and gangsters and pimps in blackface. And, you know, those who really know and understand hip-hop know that hip-hop is much, much more than that. It's much bigger than that. But somehow, you know, we've gotten to this place where it's almost like a joke. It's almost like a minstrelsy. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like we've gone backwards.
And yet, at the end of the day and at the end of the film, you end where you began. You say, I love hip-hop. Tell us again, what is it, the thing that it is that's the brilliance?
Well, you know, when I listen to a group like Dead Prez and I hear their power and I hear how they are, you know, trying to use hip-hop as a vehicle to educate and inform and inspire and challenge. I think that's a beautiful thing, and I think it's a great thing, and I think it's a very powerful thing. I refuse to be a stereotype in your box. Never want to try to be something I'm not. I'm just from the block. There are things to be proud of. You know, there are things to be happy about, and there are things to love. I love the beats. I love the way the voices sound, riding over the beats. You know what I mean? I love the sort of that self-affirming feel that I get out of hip hop. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I just, you know, the problem is that, you know, the substance has been drained. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like somebody just opened a drain and just drained all of the substance and the meat and the power out of the music. And that's what I think a lot of people like me who love hip hop but question it and challenge it are very disappointed about right now.
Byron Hurt has made a film about his feelings. It's called Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes. Byron Hurt, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin, for having me. I appreciate it.
And Byron's documentary will be airing as part of the PBS Independent Lens series this month, Black History Month. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. And a quick note, next week, a scholar in black history will respond to your letters about the debate over Barack Obama's blackness. Is someone less black if they aren't descendants of American slaves? You might remember we had that very provocative conversation, and we'll have your response next week. That's next week, but still to come today, how a U.S. general flew to Hollywood to get the hit television show 24 to cut back on torture because soldiers in the field were copying the show's tactics. That's still ahead, here and now. I got a fat chain, I got a fat whip, I got a fat, get off that bullshit. Crank up your speakers, your woofers and your tweakers. Turn up your receivers. I'm Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Everyone breaks eventually. That's the credo of 24, the violence-laden drama on the Fox television network. And it might also apply to the show's producers, who may have bowed to pressure about 24's use of torture. Each week, 15 million viewers watch a single hour in an impossibly tense day of counterterrorism agent Jack Bauer. The Parents Television Council cited 67 torture scenes in the first 5 seasons of the show. Some of the tactics, waterboarding, electrocution, or this week's power drilling into a man's shoulder. A warning, these scenes are not just hard to watch, they can be tough to listen to.
Your time is up!
Human rights groups have long complained about the show's use of torture, but now the military is as well. This past fall, the dean of West Point, Brigadier General Patrick Finnegan, along with professional interrogators, told the show's writers to stop because soldiers were copying 24's tactics. Well, Philadelphia Inquirer columnist Gail Schister reports that the show has decided to cut back on torture. Not because of complaints, but they say because it's becoming something of a cliché. Jane Mayer is staff writer for The New Yorker. This week she explored the role of torture on 24, and we turn to her now for some background on this. Welcome, Jane.
Hi.
3 officials, including General Finnegan, flew out to California to meet with the creative team. Tell us more about what they said happened in that meeting.
Well, what the reason the dean of West Point went out there was to try to convince them to show that torture, A, doesn't work, and B, is illegal on the show. He didn't go out there to try to censor anything, but simply to try to convince them to show torture in a more jaundiced view.
What did he say that his students at West Point were saying to him?
They love Jack Bauer, and they want to be like Jack Bauer, and they're saying to their professors in the law of war class, you know, if torture doesn't work, how come it works for Jack Bauer? And, you know, maybe we ought to be torturing people, because, look, it seems to save the day on the show 24 every week.
You also quote another professor at West Point, Gary Solis, who also taught law of war for commanders at West Point. He also related anecdotes about trying to tell kids what?
It's the wrong thing for America to do, that it gives a, you know, an image of America around the world that is toxic, and that torture really doesn't work. I mean, I think the thing that's been interesting to me is that the more people know about interrogation, the people who really do interrogations, and there was a top FBI interrogator who went out there too, both in law enforcement and in the military, they will tell you that if you torture somebody, they will talk, they'll say anything, they'll tell you anything to make the pain stop. So you get a lot of bad information from people that way, and then you're misled about what to do.
You write that Professor Solis told you that his students were impressed by a scene in which Bauer barges into a room, shoots a suspect in the leg, and then threatens to shoot the other?
And, of course, the guy talks. So, yeah, they wanted to repeat the experiment in their own work in, you know, the battlefields. And, you know, really one of the saddest parts of the story that I wrote was I interviewed a interrogator in Iraq named Tony Lagaranis, who was in the army, and you know, he's really a shaken man. He's somebody who saw people tortured in Iraq, or at least this is what he says. He saw people having their bones broken and being made to sit on hot exhaust pipes where they would get third-degree burns, and he was supposed to interrogate them afterwards. And I think that the kind of the vision of what he saw is so dark in his mind and kind of stays with him. And he basically said that what he was seeing was, A, that after the suspects were hurt in these ways, they didn't talk. They didn't get anything special out of them. So he doesn't think that it works. But he also said that he saw colleagues watch DVDs of American shows like 24 and see these kind of sadistic tactics being used and then want to try them themselves.
Well, you write that he says he would watch the 24 on a DVD and then walk into an interrogation booth and do the same thing.
Right. So there's a copycat problem. It exists for a particular reason right now. Also, I think you can say that, you know, that the rules of engagement in terms of how to interrogate suspects in the war on terror have been very confusing to troops on the ground. It was unclear to many soldiers what the rules were, and they were specifically told in places like Iraq to take the gloves off, and they weren't sure really what that meant. So they were all watching these DVDs, and I guess many of them got the wrong idea. So you've got good soldiers doing bad things.
Well, and there was another veteran interrogator there, Stuart Harrington, who told some of the 24 writers other things they could do. He listed tactics. And yet, what was their response overall?
Well, there was something of an impasse, I gather, because the creators of the show, while they're worried about this to some extent, they make the argument that entertainers have made throughout the years, which is it's just entertainment. You know, basically, give us a break. The way the show is created, they need to use torture as a plot device. I mean, every week you've got this ticking time bomb situation going on, and it creates sort of maximum suspense and gets your adrenaline charging, and then Jack Bauer needs to solve the crime incredibly quickly. So he resorts to sort of pain, because the things that really work when it comes to interrogation take a long amount of time.
And you write that the show's writers would listen to some of this and say that's great, but it takes too long.
It takes too long, right. Yeah. It takes too long for a primetime TV show.
This all brings us to the show's co-creator, Joel Surnow, who was not in that meeting. He told you that he has attention deficit disorder and couldn't sit still.
He hates meetings. He didn't want to meet with the West Point people, and he had other things to do, I guess. But
well, who is he, and is this show his agenda?
Joel Surnow describes himself as a right-wing nut job, and so he has a sense of humor about his own politics, but he's a very, very conservative guy, particularly as Hollywood goes, and he himself has a strong belief that you got to use hard power to fight for America against the evils of the world, and he's a big supporter of Bush and close friend of Rush Limbaugh, and he's been in the White House for lunch where he had a good time visiting with Karl Rove and Lynn Cheney, who turns out to be an extreme fan.
So, Jay Mayer, I guess the question is, has he said there's an agenda to
the show? Well, listen, what Joel Surnow will say, in his view, the show represents a fantasy solution to what America really needs. He thinks America really wants somebody like Jack Bauer to fight the war on terror the way Jack Bauer does, above the law, outside the law, kind of a vigilante who could use roving death squads inside the United States. I mean, and so, he knows, he realizes it's a fantasy, but in some ways it also it makes a political argument, and particularly on one subject. I mean, you can see that the show is ambivalent in many ways on many political topics, but on one subject it's consistent, which is it believes and projects that if you use torture, it will work in the war on terror on suspects working against America. It's on one side on that issue.
Jane Mayer, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Her article on 24 appears in the recent issue. Jane, thanks so much.
Glad to be with you.
And now, of course, the show's writers have said they are going to pull back on the use of torture in the program. That's what Gail Schister in the Philadelphia Inquirer reports. So we'll be listening on Monday to see. Still to come before we go today, the story of a man whose lifelong dedication to turtles has brought him fame and now fortune. You're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. Sunday's NBA All-Star Game is being overshadowed by homophobic comments made by a former player on a radio talk show in Miami. Joining us now to talk about that and the other news from the world of sports is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And as we always say with you, sports and a whole lot more. And that's what we get here. We want to listen to part of this conversation, Tim Hardaway, who was asked by ESPN radio host Dan Le Batard how he'd react to a gay teammate. Now, we should say this didn't come out of nowhere. There was recently another former player who revealed that he is gay. This is John Amici, who wrote about it in a book. So it was in that spirit that Dan Le Batard asked Tim Hardaway how he'd feel about a gay teammate. Here is his response.
First of all, I wouldn't want him on my team. And second of all, you know, if he was on my team, I would really distance myself from him because I don't think that's right. And I don't think that, you know, he should be in a locker room while we're in a locker room.
You know that what you're saying there, though, Timmy, is flatly homophobic, right? It's just it's bigotry.
Well, you know, I hate gay people. So, you know, I let it be known. I don't like gay people. I don't like to be around gay people. I'm homophobic.
So, Bill Littlefield, I almost drove off the road when I hear this. It goes on for quite a while, and he's since said, Tim Hardaway has since said that he's sorry, that he shouldn't have said anything, that that was my mistake. He says, I regret it. He told this to WSVN-TV in Miami. Some are saying that this is revealing homophobia in sports. You say what?
Homophobia is in all sorts of places. Sports is one of those places, but I don't think this reveals anything except that Tim Hardaway's kind of a dumb guy and sort of unenlightened and not very smart about what he chooses to say when there's a microphone on.
Well, John Amici, who was, we mentioned, the former NBA player who disclosed his homosexuality this week, he says he's getting tons of hate mail and others. I'm looking at an article in The Guardian in Britain. What do they, you know, possibly what do they know? But they're saying that that hate mail that he's getting coupled with, you know, that this response, that this comment from Tim Hardaway is revealing the truth about how athletes might feel about a gay player.
I think it's very hard to talk about the truth of what athletes might feel. Mm-hmm. Athletes come in all shapes and sizes and colors and points of view, just like all the rest of us do. And some of them have vile opinions and behave badly.
Have any NBA players who are currently playing, have any come forward to say that they were homosexual?
No. And I think that it's interesting that numbers of active females team sport athletes have come forward and said that they're gay, but not with male athletes in basketball, baseball, football, you know, the high-profile sports.
Mm. Well, NASCAR had a tough week, too. It opens its season Sunday in Daytona, but don't look now, Ricky Bobby. For the second year in a row, there's a cheating scandal involving NASCAR newcomer Toyota and apparently rocket fuel. What's going on here?
Well, first of all, the rocket fuel was apparently used in order to get a sluggish Camry running better, and so I got to get me some of that rocket fuel because my Camry isn't running so good right now. They say in NASCAR that if you're not cheating, you're not trying. I mean, that's an old NASCAR saying, and so to some extent, this is simply business as usual. What's unusual is that some of the most high-profile drivers have been caught have been penalized.
But caught, and to some of us, this is Michael Waltrip, who admitted, he said he's sorry. He was just trying to juice up his car.
I'm sorry. I was just trying to go faster.
His car's been impounded. He's been docked. NASCAR kicked his crew chief and manager out of this weekend's race. But is he's still there?
Yes, Michael Waltrip will still be racing. They have this complicated procedure of docking you championship points, and then they can move your car back further in the pack at the start. But no, he'll still be racing. And you know, the last thing that NASCAR wants to do is take headlining drivers out of the race.
Oh, sure. That would be bad. Well, you know, none of this matters to many people because the big news is that it's, you know, spring training, not a day too soon for many. And for the Boston Red Sox, the new pitcher from Japan, I call him Daisuke Matsusaka. Have I got that right?
It's
We're getting
close enough.
To,
almost as close as anybody else.
Making friends in Red Sox Nation. Just in the few seconds we have, what are his prospects?
His prospects for becoming an even bigger star in Japan are excellent. I don't know what he's going to do as far as balls and strikes and wins and losses.
Well, we'll be watching. Bill Littlefield, Here Now Sports Guy, host of NPR's Only a Game. For more on the world of sports, always tune in on the weekend. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the world of wildlife, as in the world of fashion, the runway is dominated by the glamorous. Lions and tigers and bears, gorillas and whales and elephants get most of the attention, as do the naturalists who study them. But away from these models of megafauna and much more down to earth are the turtles. And their biggest and hardworking fan has suddenly become a big star. Here Now's David Boeri has our story. It begins on a cold day in a wetland in New Hampshire.
Long before these wetlands were ever here, there were turtles. They were here before the first ice age. In fact, they were even here before the dinosaurs. Turtles saw dinosaurs come and go. They even saw the first flowering plants. But now, in relatively short order, all that is changing. In even faster order, so too is the world of David Carroll.
What we're going to do is push through this little bit of brush, trying not to slip on the snow.
Wintertime has come to Warner, a growing town west of Concord, New Hampshire. In a stand of white pine and a thicket of red maple here at the edge of a brook, the man locals call Swamp Walker shows me prime habitat for turtles.
And this stream reach right here is an area where I have spent many, many hours with the wood turtles over a couple of decades now.
Around his neck, David Carroll wears amulets of carved turtles. A black headband keeps his silver and white hair back. He is a child of the 60s, a spiritual descendant of Thoreau. And when it comes to turtles, no one with 2 feet comes closer to knowing the clan. He is Swamp Walker.
You represent to me the 19th century natural historian. A non-biologist who comes of knowledge through personal experience and lots of commitment to that.
I mean, there's still a tremendous amount of actual science, with a capital S, that can be done with a good pair of eyes, time, patience, and a notebook, pencil.
Ants march, you know, birds take wing, butterflies float, and if you were studying big game, they kind of bound away, but turtles just sort of endure. So you must spend a lot of time fairly still.
Yeah, I do.
And non-mobile.
Yep, and that's my style too.
David Carroll bonded with a spotted turtle when he was a boy of 8 in Pennsylvania. For 56 years since, he has been undeterred by mosquitoes, black flies, brambles, brush, and big holes into which he's occasionally sunk up to his neck in waders. He's played Homer to the Odyssey of turtles, traveling ponds, marshes, brooks, bogs, swamps, and mud. Of wood turtles alone, he's chronicled the lives of 250.
You know, I'll wait a certain distance, and then I'll wait and I'll watch. I'll wait a certain distance, I'll wait and I'll watch.
There's only the snow and ice to watch today, but next month will come the thaw and the melt, and David will begin his 8-month field season of wading and fording and following turtles. But for now, they're hibernating, and so is he.
Yeah, I'm ready. Well, we'll make our way upstairs to what I refer to as my Arbeitszimmer. It's now a collection of 2 rooms in which I do my writing and my artwork.
In a drafty old colonial with peeling paint and paper, David Carroll turns storyteller atop the duff and disarray of hundreds of journals of his notes and sketches. In 3 magnificent works called the Wet Sneaker Trilogy and the acclaimed Self-Portrait with Turtles, Carroll has detailed their life histories and ecology in exquisite narrative, rich watercolors, and finely drawn pen and ink.
So here I have this image. Some people interpret this as a turtle coming out of a marsh, but she is actually digging on an open sandy plain in the light of a full moon.
On the modest sales of his books and his illustrations, reproduced in prints, magnets, and T-shirts, David and his wife Lorette scrambled and scratched out a subsistence. No health insurance, dying cars, a failing roof. All that brings us to a phone call Lorette handed off to David a few months ago.
So he came in and I knew something really important was happening, but I didn't know what. And then he was asked not to tell anybody. So we had to wait till our friend left before he could tell me what was happening. And then it was just so wildly exciting.
I have gone from somebody who thought, well, you know, this work will probably be worth more after I'm gone, to now thinking, oh my goodness, I'm suddenly worth money alive.
as my friend Brian Butler, great turtle scout in Massachusetts, wonderful guy, signed off his recent postcard, "Look both ways before you cross the street."
The reason David Carroll is suddenly worth real money alive was the reason for that secret phone call. On the other end, the MacArthur Foundation had told him he'd been selected for its commonly dubbed Genius Award. The MacArthur jury had decided Swamp Walker has the eye of an artist, the mind of a scientist, the voice of a great storyteller, and the soul of a conservationist. And along with that bouquet, they threw in $500,000 without strings. The first 100,000 have just come in.
I was kind of wishing it would come in a Wells Fargo truck and big stacks of greenbacks. But it's real money, I guess.
Real money. Now he can heat his art studio. Now he calls his wife Lady MacArthur. He just bought her a new car. They call it Swamp Mobile, to replace the old clunker. David even has the luxury of worrying he won't live long enough to get the next four annual installments of cash.
This is not the ordinary category for this kind of award, you know, and I thought of it, well, you know, in a way, it's kind of a victory for the mud people. And I love that. I love that about it.
Here is where you might like the story to end. Amidst the joy and affirmation of Swamp Walker's splash, yet the moment of David Carroll's greatest success is coincided with the loss of the wetlands he loves most, the habitat he's been showing us today.
As a matter of fact, I am writing elegies to turtles and to places, and that's getting increasingly more difficult for me.
Just as Thoreau found out in another wetland, Carroll has learned that trafficking with humans is far more taxing than traveling with turtles.
I've had to migrate north as my beloved turtle places were either marginalized out of ecological meaning or downright paved and disappeared entirely. That's what brought me to New Hampshire 37 years ago. And then I discovered these incredible wetlands. But I see all those signs of problems occurring. Again, I bought myself maybe a third of a century by coming here.
And the irony of his last and keenest sense of loss is that it's coming not at the hands of developers with their houses, roads, and shopping centers, but at the hands of well-intentioned conservationists who are promoting public access and all that comes with it. Instead of preserving the wild, Carroll foresees pets, predators, poachers, and paths running wild.
They get a place and they just absolutely riddle it with trails, maps, signs, bring the world in. And they say, this is wonderful wildlife habitat. We have sensitive species here. We've saved this land. And it's generally, you know, and I've been involved in some, and some people congratulate me, and they don't understand that I'm actually, I feel a loss. I feel like I've lost the battle because it's not going to work.
And we'll get down to this lower floodplain here, which is, it's got some white pine growing in it. Oh, we do have some fresh beaver cuts here.
When, like Thoreau, you see that heaven is under our feet as well as above our heads, you can see hell in public use instead of preservation. When you've become artist, poet, swamp walker, and MacArthur genius, you can preach and paint for those you love most.
So this is a this is the Uber environment for wood turtles.
Wirklich. Wirklich. Uber environment. It really is.
Here and Now's David Boeri with David Carroll in Warner, New Hampshire. To see photos and video of Carroll, his artwork, and his favorite turtle haunts, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend. Watch out for turtles. And join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.